All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. My name is Fred Mitchell, longtime sports writer with the Chicago Tribune, 41 years to be exact, including a period of time where I was a beat writer covering the Cubs during the 1980s, and as a columnist beyond that, I was covering the Cubs as well. So I'm delighted to be able to be a part of this panel discussion regarding the reimagining of Wrigley Field. And we have a lot of history to delve into and a lot of current additions that have been made to Wrigley Field and plans for the future. And I'm joined on this panel with Kelly Holton, who's the brand activation manager for Populous, and she will keep us up to date on the improvements at Wrigley Field, the designs, the amenities, and that sort of thing. So she will be very informative to us. And over here on my right is Ed Hardick, who is the longtime Cubs historian, and he has a treasure fold of information and history. And I think our objective this afternoon is to provide you with some nuggets of information. Some of you are from out of town and not quite as familiar, perhaps, with Wrigley Field. And even those of you who have maybe gone to Wrigley Field for years and decades, we hope to provide you with some nuggets of information as well. So I think, you know, it's important to appreciate the facility of Wrigley Field and put it in perspective to the history of Major League Baseball and sports, and to appreciate the fact that when we think about all the older baseball teams in America and how many parks that they've changed into, whether you're talking the Pirates or the Cardinals, Cincinnati Reds, they've changed ballparks. But Wrigley Field is here in its essence and its beauty, and we're here to talk about that, and we'll leave time at the end of our presentation and discussion and conversation for questions from you and perhaps some stories and anecdotes as well. We hope to provide that. And to start us out, Ed, if you could give us an overview of the history of Wrigley Field and some anecdotes and some nuggets of information.
Okay, briefly. So in a little bit, Kelly is going to show you some slides of the changes to the ballpark. These changes are all part of a project called the 1060 Project. 1060 being the address of Wrigley Field. It was a five-year, $750 million project to save the ballpark. On the face, the ballpark looked great, but structurally, the ballpark was aged. Time had caught up to the ballpark, and it was imperative to save Wrigley Field. Now, what Wrigley Field was saved to? Well, the Cubs purposely are taking the ballpark back to the 1930s, the images we know of the ballpark from the 30s. So how did we get there? So very briefly, let me show you some slides on the ballpark. This first slide just simply emphasizes that the ballpark was built in 1914. Wrigley Field is the second oldest ballpark in the majors. The only park older, of course, is? Shocker. Fenway was 1912, Wrigley Field was 1914. The ballpark was actually built for the team called the Chicago Federals, or the Chi-Feds of the short-lived Federal League. The second year, the team was renamed the Chicago Whales, and then in 1916, that's when the Cubs first started playing at the ballpark. But when the ballpark first opened, it was a very simple structure. It was a single-story grandstand that went from the left field foul pole around home plate out to the right field foul pole. There was a small section of bleachers in right field, a scoreboard in center. Initially it was in left. park sat 14,000 people and was built at a cost of $250,000. In addition, the park was built in 6 weeks. That includes time to take down the old seminary buildings that were on the property. There also was a strike. Renovations at the ballpark began almost right away. Within 10 days, they were already making changes to the ballpark. The distance down the left field line was considered too short. So, believe it or not, after the first homestand, they tore out the original wall. They moved the scoreboard from left field to center. Now, it turns out that there's that, in that upper right corner, there's a house right there that's on the property. The person who had the lease on the property still had a couple months to go on the lease, so they refused to move. The original plan was to tear the house down and be able to move the wall back, but they wouldn't leave. So what they did is they tore off the porch on the house, and they pretty much moved the left field wall to the person's the back of the house. So again, you know, the Wrigley Field, the history of Wrigley Field is change. It's many, many renovations. Regarding some of those changes, we have the large picture shows that in the mid-20s, they actually added additional bleachers to the ballpark. Upper corner, you see the park is now double-decked. That happened between 1926 and 1928. And with that, the capacity of the park went from 14,000 when it first opened to about 40,000. And then the bottom corner, in 1934, the Cubs added the reader board at Wrigley Field. Today we call it the marquee, but it was originally installed as the reader board from a local company called the Federated Sign Company. Again, that's 1934. And in 1937, this is the whopper. This is the renovation of the ballpark that most of us have known Wrigley Field as. 1937, they tore out the old bleachers. The bleachers that went in the 1920s were the chain link fence type bleachers that you look through. P.K. Wrigley, who inherited the team after his father's death, hated those bleachers. He wanted them elevated for better sight lines, and he also wanted them made of brick. So in the summer of 1937, the Cubs were about 5 games up at the time. Mr. Wrigley said, you know what, we've talked about doing this renovation for a long time. Let's go ahead and do it. We'll be ready for the 1937 World Series. It was done, and so far, unfortunately, so were the Cubs. But it was in 1937. That's when the scoreboard was built. That's when the triangle-shaped bleachers were first built. The distinctive red brick. That's when the ivy was planted. That's when the W flag was first used. We're all talking about the late 1930s. So when you look at Wrigley Field today, the work of the 1060 project was first to take the ballpark back to those golden days of the 1930s, when the ballpark was fresh and clean. And then to that, add the amenities that Kelly's going to talk about in a few minutes. But the ballpark purposely looks like the 1930s. That's when the park was fresh. The Cubs were playing for were winning the pennant every 3 years from 1929 to 1938. But it's this image, it's this feeling, it's the terracotta awning on the ticket booths. It's the view of the neighborhood. These are the kind of things that the Cubs are trying to recapture with the 1060 project. And that's why we're here today. Oh, and by the way, here's a picture of Fred.
I don't go back to the 1930s. But this particular picture was taken in 1984. And I was covering a Cubs game for the Chicago Tribune in the old press box, which at that time was located directly behind home plate, really a prime location for us sports writers. The only thing you had to be careful was a foul ball could come back and smash your computer, and that could cause problems. But one reason this picture is interesting is the fact that, think of 1984, you had no internet, no social media, none of that. So I thought at that time that I was pretty advanced, and I was able to listen to the game on transistor radio, and I was keeping score in my scorebook, obviously, and looking at the probably looking at the box scores from yesterday's game or something in the Tribune back when they would have all those details. But that shows you some of the advancements since 1984.
And then with the 1060 project, you know, looking at all of the historic imagery and just getting a feel for how much it has transformed, it transformed the neighborhood. I mean, with the development surrounding, you have Hotel Zachary across the street, you have the Gallagher Way Plaza, which is open 365 and full of free programming for the community, a real new park for the neighborhood. And the ballpark really has transformed. And I'm the brand activation director at Populous, so what I'll speak to today is how some of this extensive history and legacy really influenced the design and the experiences at the ballpark. So where I started on the project was working on really investigating the Cubs' history and understanding it for their new headquarters building and the lobby, and your first impression when you first take a tour or visit Wrigley Field, and getting a sense of that history and that iconic moment of Ernie Banks at the front door. But the ballpark renovations really, you know, are intended to add revenue-generating amenities as well that diversify the experience, provide something for everyone, provide what fans today are looking for in a modern ballpark experience. And these are a variety of the clubs we'll go over in a little bit, as well as concourse improvements and everything being authentic to 1930s, using neon for signage and referencing those iconic elements. And then brand moments and even celebrating the brick throughout, and printed murals on, or painted murals on the brick, and really honoring that history. And Gallagher Way. Hopefully you've experienced it or have some time to check it out and see how it's, you know, really impacted that space, alleviated some congestion on the concourse, and really adds to your game day experience at Wrigley Field.
So I see a variety of a range of ages here today, and some of you in my generation recall perhaps the first time you saw a game at Wrigley Field, and maybe you had a black and white TV as a kid and didn't have the opportunity to see it in color for the first time. So many people talk about walking up the steps at Wrigley Field, looking out at the green grass and the ivy on the walls, and the great imagery that's there. And I know that people want to retain so much of the quaintness and the history of Wrigley Field, but at the same time, we know times are changing, and player salaries are changing, and revenue has to change with that. And I think Wrigley Field and the Cubs have done an excellent job of doing that balancing act of retaining the things that people love about the ballpark, but at the same time, adding amenities that you see at more modern ballparks and things that fans and players, for that matter, demand. So, Kelly, my question to you is that, you know, during this major project, how did you handle that balancing act of retaining the history and quaintness of Wrigley Field, and yet at the same time making it more modern?
And that was our number one design challenge, was really to create a design that felt authentic to the place, because it's our role to amplify that sense of place when you're here. And Wrigley Field is a unique place because it has such a strong brand in itself, in addition to the Cubs brand, and how do you honor that? And it was through extensive research and understanding the iconography, especially, you know, from the 1930s and what Ed spoke to, but the usage of flags, the Otis Shepherd and artwork that he created for scorecards, and all of these references that are pulled in to even the smallest details of the design to really honor that legacy and history. And ultimately, it came down to tradition, beauty, and charm, and doing that, you know, as our foundation of the story throughout. So these are some images of what Wrigley Field looked like previously. You can tell by the cars. These photos are not just last year or just before the 1060 renovations, but a few years back. You see a lot of stucco. You see chain link fence. There were renovations that occurred over the years that were treated a little differently. So then this is an iconic image from the 1930s that was a huge reference for the project. The current ballpark, and having established guidelines from Chicago Landmarks and the National Park Service, and really retaining that historic look from the 1930s. So you see the terracotta eyebrows over the ticket windows. You see decorative ironwork over to the far side of the image, the marquee. We even renumbered the gates and recreated the signs that you see here where it says gate 3 and directing you to gates 4, 5, and 1 and 2. And here today, this is what the ballpark looks like now, and you can see the similarities between the two photos and how they connect with one another. And here's a detailed view of some of that ironwork and just bringing back some of that beauty. Some of these areas are what used to be chain link fence, so really, really, you know, putting emphasis into those details. And then when I first got involved in the project, it was, again, with the Cubs headquarters, or the entry to their office in the lobby, and really celebrating the iconic moments of history. So here, this is actually a split flap. Each of these panels of Ernie Banks here, it's kind of like a Rolodex on a motor. So there's 10 different images, and it cycles through them like a historic train schedule board with his iconic quote above in the ceiling. And your first impression of Cubs history, we reference the flags and the ceiling treatment above. Those reflect the pennants that are flown above the roof at Wrigley Field. Otis Shepherd artwork painted on the brick to the left, the silver sluggers, the gold gloves, and a home for the World Series trophy. As we were working on this project, we had just started, we were diving into research, we were getting to know the Cubs, the brand, and the brand evolved. And it was a very exciting time to be involved in the project, to design a home for the World Series trophy, and do that in on a pedestal that's not behind glass, but one that's exposed and you could take a photo with it. Oftentimes it's the NLCS trophy on display here, but giving access to that to the people. And for us, it's about how do we take this historic brand and create an experience out of that and do it on your journey throughout the ballpark or throughout the office building. So this is just an example of how we start to think about that. What are the stories you feel and hear in this lobby space? How do we spread them throughout the building? How do you do that on different elevator levels? How do you, you know, keep that journey going throughout all your touch points with the ballpark? This is one of the elevator lobbies. We had a custom flag made to honor 1876 and the foundation of the team. And Otis Shepherd was hugely influential, another elevator lobby as you're rising throughout the building.
Could you, Ed, tell us a little bit more about Otis Shepherd?
So have any of you seen these scorecards? 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, the Cubs actually used the Otis Shepherd designs on the scorecards. Some of the sporting news publications in the 50s also would have used them. Otis was with the Cubs from the early 1930s until 1963. His scorecards actually used through 1968. But during 30-plus years with the Cubs, Otis pretty much signed off on any design element at the ballpark. The triangular shape of the center field bleachers, the pinstripes on the uniforms, the squatchy, the red squatchy on the top of the hat, that's from Otis Shepherd. He designed the Women's League uniforms. Again, any type of design, type of element, Otis Shepherd for 30-plus years, it was pretty much his design. The idea of flying the W flags, the idea of flying the standings flags from the center field scoreboard, these all came from Otis Shepherd.
And wasn't he also associated with Wrigley Gum?
Yes, Otis actually was initially hired as the art director for the gum company. And of course, Mr. Wrigley knew how to get him a second job. He also was a member of the Cubs board of directors for about 25 years. So, and his wife, Dorothy, was actually just as talented, maybe even more so than Otis was. The two of them actually sort of helped the idea of billboards. As the car was becoming really popular, they popularized, you know, the billboard articles or billboards, and it wasn't simply buy this, buy that. They tried to appeal to a feeling, to an emotion, and he tried to, you know, build that as part of Wrigley Field with this very unique airbrush style of paintings.
Yeah, and Otis Shepherd's artwork is woven into the entire ballpark experience. A lot of the murals that you see there are referenced or inspired by Otis Shepherd scorecards and visuals, even down to the arrows used on the wayfinding.
And if you visit the Cubs gift shop behind home plate, you'll see along one of the walls, the whole wall is just covered with Otis Shepherd designs. Just very classic, you know, the baby bear, the mama and the papa bear. So again, Otis is very, very important for the Cubs. You know, again, he's been gone 50-some years.
And here you see one of the wayfinding directional signs throughout the concourse. These were intentionally designed. Even the arrows you see in yellow reference the arrow used on Wrigley gum wrappers. So every detail was really specific.
We showed a picture of what the old scoreboard looked like, and I know you probably didn't look at it because I didn't emphasize it, but there used to be two L's on top of the scoreboard. People seen that picture anywhere? Yes? No? Look for it. The elves have that arrow as their hats.
And the signage also references the mechanical scoreboard. It has removable panels. It's meant to function similarly to the mechanical scoreboard, and I'm sure Ed has some stories about the mechanical scoreboard as well.
That scoreboard, okay. Imagine this. Sit, grab a TV, and go up in your grandmother's attic in the middle of summer and watch a baseball game. That actually is cooler than the scoreboard. There are some cooling elements up there. They're called open slots on either side of the scoreboard for ventilation. But for the most part, the scoreboard, you're in a three-story tin can that when it rains, it's loud as can be. But again, it's a classic scoreboard, hand-operated. Notice it only has room for 12 games rather than, you know, 15 possible games, but it's still hand operated. The center part of the scoreboard is actually run from the back of the press box. Watch a Cubs game sometime and see how quickly Rick Fuse changes the ball strikes. He's amazingly quick and amazingly accurate. He's just a member of the grounds crew. He sits in the back of the press box. He's got a perfect view of the umpire's back heel. If the umpire steps back, he knows it's going to be a strike. Rick hits the strike button, then the umpire goes, strike. I didn't tell you that. That's a trade secret.
And just some additional views of the concourse and just how that was also elevated throughout the project. Every detail, you see some elements to the left and right of cocktails, that line work references line work from the marquee, the usage of neon, trying to be authentic and true to this era of legacy and history throughout.
So, seeing the elevator on the previous slide, it helped remind me of how primitive it used to be for us in the press box. To go from the press box to the locker rooms immediately after the game, we writers would have to navigate our way through the crowd exiting the game. And a lot of times we were on tight deadlines and made it very treacherous to try to get down there. Now there's an elevator dedicated for the media. An example, I covered the June 23rd, 1984 Sandberg game. And so what we would do is if we saw a game was kind of in hand, we would go down to the area, actually box seats, empty box seats, that we could grab behind the Cubs dugout so that we could have quick access to the locker room after the game and we wouldn't have to battle the crowd. So, of course, with the Sandberg game, we're down there, and then he ties it up and go an extra inning, so we got to head back up to the press box, and he ties it up again, and it's, you know, we're going back and forth. But that's an art form that we had to develop to be able to navigate our way to the locker room from the press box.
So just to peel back the curtain a bit more, talk through some of the premium amenities that have been added to Wrigley Field as part of the 1060 project, starting with the Maker's Mark Barrel Room. So this space was designed to feel like a speakeasy. It's located, it's subterranean, it's below the seating bowl, it's a dramatic entry to the space. All of the imagery along the left side, they're framed black and white images of both Cubs history and Maker's Mark history, and then the TVs above are also displayed in black and white, and to stay really truly authentic to that time period. And then the Maker's Mark brand is woven in seamlessly throughout. Here's a view, the window, those framed images actually open, some of them as secret windows into the batting tunnel. So to tell that speakeasy story, to build a memory, to build a moment of discovery within the club. The bar itself, that wood feature below, those are barrel staves from Maker's Mark barrels. And then this, you know, historic period, this club only uses this version of the Cubs logo, which is from this time period of Maker's Mark's founding, along with the era celebrated for the Cubs in this club. An art piece, it's the barrel room, and Maker's Mark dips in wax, so a barrel dipped in wax is for the barrel room for Maker's Mark. And then the W Club, in terms of providing something for everyone, or diversifying the offering, the W Club really celebrates more of the modern day Cubs brand. It celebrates the great players. Here you see numbers on tables, the field wall distance on the wall. Another reference to Otis Shepherd and some of the scorecard imagery at the entry from the concourse. And celebrating the W and flying the flag and painted murals on brick. Also, to stay current, the club also displays game-used artifacts, so jerseys, bats, balls used from the latest home run or the latest homestand to really keep it relevant and keep rich facts occurring in the club at all times. And the Catalina Club was inspired by Cubs spring training when it was hosted on Catalina Island. And so the club has a very different feel from the others. It does feel more like you're on Catalina Island, maybe, than at Wrigley Field. It has great views of the field. It's in the upper deck at home plate. And even the usage of tile references to that feeling of Catalina Island. And the imagery as well, just seeing the Cubs playing with the palm trees and the signage and the logo also references. You can see here the sailing flags or the alphabet used to identify the club in the logo as well. But I'm sure Ed also has some stories to tell here.
My turn. Oh, so Catalina Island, if you're not familiar, William Wrigley Jr. purchased Catalina Island in 1919. 2 years later, the Cubs actually started spending spring training on the island. Maybe not the entire time, but initially just the pitchers and catchers would report to Catalina Island. And the Cubs would train on Catalina through 1951, minus a year or two, you know, during World War II when they trained in French Lick. The way you would get to Catalina, which is, by the way, it's about 26 miles off the coast of L.A., the way you would get to Catalina Island is you would hop on a Wilmington transport ship or, in later years, plane. The W for Wilmington is the W flag we know at Wrigley Field. The first W flag at Wrigley flew in 1938 was simply a Wilmington blue flag with a white W. In the 80s, it was changed to the current white with the blue W, but the W came from the Wilmington Transport Company. Again, it's another Otis Shepard touch on the ballpark. But again, the Wrigley family owned this. I think they've turned it over to a conservatorship for the most part nowadays, but Catalina Island, still today, it's beautiful. It's a great aviary. You love exotic birds. But again, the connection was owned by Mr. Wrigley. It was designed by Otis and Dorothy Shepherd. They designed all the signage. They designed the uniforms for the people working at the movie theater. They designed the port. Again, it's all the touches of Otis Shepherd and Mr. Wrigley from the 20s to the 1950s.
And that connection to the W flag and that rich history there became a really strong driver for the design of the club to reference Catalina. Next, the American Airlines 1914 Club. So you saw an image from 1914 as the first slide of today's presentation from Wegman Park. And this club was designed to celebrate that era, the era of Art Deco. It's the most premium experience in the ballpark. It's located directly behind and under home plate. It uses antique glass, warm, bright lighting. It's a very elegant space. And then as you descend down into the club, this is a view of one of the many brick walls that are painted with murals throughout the ballpark. But here again, this club celebrates the logo from the Federals, celebrating the whales, the logos of this era, and staying true to that within this club. I'll tee up one more story from Ed on the whales.
Okay, so we see the first sign there, the Chi Feds, okay? Chicago Federals, simple, right? Well, that's what the team was called that first year. They were the Chi Feds of the Federal League. Not a lot of creativity at that time, apparently, right? So the Cubs decide, or Cubs, the Charles Wiegman, the owner of the team, decides he's going to have a name the team contest for the 1915 season. And believe it or not, they get 10 different entries for the name Whales. Now, the question is why even one entry for the name Whales, but they actually got 10. As part of the entry, you were supposed to explain why you came up with the name. Well, it turns out at the time, the word whale meant great or grand. Like, oh, that's whale. Okay, that's great. In addition, whale meat was a delicacy. Someone else wrote that a whale just doesn't beat up the opponent, it wallops it. The winning entry, and they took the multiple and they picked one, it was a guy named Dave Eishoff. His explanation of why Wales was because of Waveland Avenue out beyond left field. Waveland Avenue would often flood after heavy rains, and he thought the best person to play there would be a whale. Not person, you know what I mean.
So even with partnership, our goal throughout the design was always to weave them in seamlessly and feel like a part of this environment and this place. American Airlines, I don't believe they were around in 1914, but we could tie them to Chicago. So through vintage posters advertising American Airlines flights to Chicago, working within their history archives and selecting photographs of celebrities and famous people, some of which landing at O'Hare, but tying in that feeling of history and connection to place through some of their historic imagery as well. So with all of those images, I hoped to peel back the curtain a bit, give you a feel for the details and thought and the research that influenced the design decisions that were made as part of the 1060 project. And it's one I will always remember and consider one of my favorite places on earth.
Great. All right, thank you, Kelly. I'm curious, how much were surveys implemented to make some of the decisions that populace made as far as what fans wanted in terms of amenities and perhaps even the players?
Yeah, the Cubs used extensive surveys and fan research to understand what the desires of the fans were. Surveys are always interesting. You often find out about restrooms through them. So I know that was an influence. For us, we're always utilizing data and consumer data as well. We always want to understand what the full journey of a person's day game is like. So, you know, hopefully they arrive and they experience Gallagher Way and it's a big part of their pregame experience and extend that journey as much as possible. But, you know, we are all about designing for humans and designing for those journeys. So surveys and data inform a lot of it and how we can make the best decisions that appeal to a broad demographic.
And of course, you know, when I think of Wrigley Field, I think of not only the Cubs, but so many other events that have occurred there. Obviously, the Bears played there for about 50 years, I believe. And as a child, my father would take me not only to the Cubs baseball games, but during the football season, we would go to Wrigley Field, and we had seats in what was called the East Stands, which on the baseball diamond would be out in right field. Really great location. You were right behind the visitor's bench and had really great access there. And so there's a nostalgic feel for me to remember as a child holding my father's hand, walking down Addison Street, heading to Wrigley Field, and then to many years later be able to cover baseball games there. It's like one of those wow moments for me. But speaking of, you know, the Bears and the Cubs, Ed, remind our audience of some of the many other maybe non-traditional activities that have happened in Wrigley Field over the decades.
Well, first, Fred, you know those bleachers you sat in? You know what happened to those? When the Bears moved to Soldier Field, those bleachers went with the Bears, and they were in the north end zone until 1977, at which point they were condemned as being unsafe.
Now you tell me.
So in addition to the Bears playing at Wrigley Field, actually there are several other NFL teams played at Wrigley Field. The Chicago Tigers were the first team to play there as a professional team. Any Tiger fans? And before that, the Hammond All-Americans played there in 1919. Actually, Hammond played at the ballpark sort of as a test case. Could the ballpark host an NFL team? Apparently, they were happy with how things went, so that's why the Chicago Tigers played there. In addition to the Tigers playing there, the Chicago Cardinals played there that first year. One of the stories was that the Cardinals and the Tigers played a game at the end of the season and said whatever team lost had to get out of town. the Cardinals actually later came back to Wrigley Field from 1931 to 1939. So two NFL teams actually played at Wrigley for quite some time. In addition to the football, we have European football. 1914, the Illinois State Soccer Cup was played at Wrigley Field, the first soccer game. In 1933, the Glasgow Celtics, one of the most famous European clubs, played an exhibition game at the park. In 1946, it was used as the home site of the National Soccer League. There was even talk of Charlie Grimm quitting as manager of Cubs to run one of the NSL teams. Good thing he didn't. The ballpark's been used for ski jumping. There's a great photo from what's like the press box looking out, and you see the jumper is you know, flying off into space. Look at if you've ever seen that picture, the scoreboard. Look something odd about the scoreboard. Well, it's between the time that they're going to paint it from seal brown to green, and they've primed it. So during the 1943 NFL season, the Bears had to play with a scoreboard that was baby blue. The Bears complained, we're a bunch of sissies. We got a blue scoreboard. They, of course, won the NFL championship, so maybe it wasn't too bad. Other things, the Chicago Sting played here in the 70s and the 80s. The Chicago Bears, like Larry mentioned, the Chicago Blackhawks played a game here. The Cisco Kid actually had some rodeos here at the ballpark. You actually could take a challenge to ride a bronking buck, and if you could stay on it, you could win $50. Fred mentioned football. Back as early as 1923, Northwestern played at Wrigley. Loyola also played at Wrigley Field. The park's been used for lacrosse, track and field events. This week, it's actually being used for a golf event. You know, Top Flight Golf is having an event at the ballpark. It's in the days before radio and TV, if you wanted to know the election results, where did you go? Well, you went to either Wrigley Field or Comiskey Park, and they had these huge boards where they would keep the tallies of the voting. Fireworks shows, early 1900s, where would you go for a fireworks show? Well, you went to Wiegman Park, a.k.a. Wrigley Field, and they would have the fireworks show for the neighborhood at the ballpark. So again, very rich, very colorful, pretty much any sport you can name at some point in time, they played at Wrigley. Even this year, they played a little bit of cricket before they went to London.
Amazing. All right, we can entertain some questions if you might have them. I just wanted to, as you line up, mention the fact that a couple of obvious cosmetic changes that were made to Wrigley Field over the past decade, I guess, that fans had become accustomed to. One is the moving the bullpens that used to be, you know, on the left field line and the right field line, moving those out of the way. And also the advancements in the clubhouse, the Cubs clubhouse in particular. I remember I started covering the Cubs in 1983, and I think that might have been the last year that they had the Cubs locker rooms down the left field corner. Really cramped situation, very, very small, just maybe a couple of showers. Not conducive to getting along. I remember squeezing in there sometimes, maybe during a Cubs losing streak, and the players were kind of grumpy and looking for somebody to take that out on, and there was nowhere to hide. So I'm glad that they have a much more spacious and modernized facility now for the players. So, all right, we have a question. Sir.
Thank you. First of all, I had the privilege of covering the World Series in 2016 at Wrigley for Canada in French. Okay. In order to accommodate us, because of course there were more media broadcasters than usual for the World Series, they built us some kind of wooden cabin behind home plate way up in 48 hours. It was very comfortable. It was among just behind us, there was a food outlet, and we heard a lot of bonjour behind us among the fans. Well, we were identified as French broadcasters. I've been told that since then it gave the idea to the Cubs to transform it as something like luxury boxes or anyway, that there's no way we'll be able to broadcast from that place, from that location next time there will be a World Series. So my question is twofold. In all the transformation, does it take into account the fact that maybe the Cubs will be good someday soon, and they will be back in the World Series, and there will be multiple, you know, broadcasters there, and where would we be should we go back there?
Actually, I was going to ask Kelly, how come that stand is so small for the World Series trophies? Trophies, plural, please.
Because they go on tour.
Oh, yes, they go on tour, yes. So, yes, as Fred mentioned, the press box at Wrigley Field, because of the such tight spaces, you know, in 2003, 2007, 2008, et cetera, we've had to put overflow press in the stands. The one year they were right behind home plate, other times we've actually taken entire sections far down the left field line to put members of the press in the stands. Even during the season, if there's a big event, there are members of the press who will have to watch the game from inside the cafeteria and actually not see the ballpark. That's just the limitation of things. I don't see that change. I mean, they have made some improvements. Populous did a lot of things with reconfiguring some stuff upstairs in the press area. But the next time they're, 2023, when the World Series is at Wrigley Field, we're going to have to put people in the stands again. I'm sorry, so that's how. Just bear with it. Dress warmly. Yes. Dress warmly this year, people.
All right. Next question. Over here. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Uh-huh. So. Every ballpark I've ever worked at has never had enough storage. So I'm curious about a ballpark built in 1914 that didn't envision this future, what the storage and operations back of house looks like and how the club is managing that.
So one of the reasons why there's Gallagher Way is because many of the functions that were normally inside the ballpark were moved outside the park. You don't need an electrician inside the ballpark if he's right next door. You don't need the marketing department. You don't need the ticketing department. So a lot of the reasons we're able to do some of these renovations is because we took many of the functions that had been in the park and we're taking up valuable space, and then that was able to convert to these clubs and so forth. But with Gallagher Way right there, there's a, my father-in-law is a truck driver. He actually makes deliveries to Wrigley Field. He'll make his deliveries to Gallagher Way. He no longer makes them to the ballpark. So more and more stuff is at Gallagher Way. And Gallagher Way, a lot of it is actually underground too. But you're right, the concourses in 1914 versus today. The ballpark was built for 14,000 people. Now you have 40,000. So those are the things they had to balance as they went through this whole process.
All right, next question.
Hi, so yesterday I heard a presentation about the building of the other park in town and in the 80s and all the political stuff, but going back to Wrigley, I believe in the 80s the Cubs almost moved to Schaumburg, where the Boomers play now, the Independent League team, and they had the same dimensions as Wrigley. In the 80s, or throughout their history, what was the closest the Cubs ever came to leaving Wrigley, and were any of those efforts ever really ever get that close, or not?
Is my boss here? So actually there were a couple times the Cubs actually moved, almost moved. In 1964, the Cubs, White Sox, and Bears had begun negotiation to build a stadium along the lakefront. Because even in the 60s, it was acknowledged that, are you gonna spend $500 million and fix up a ballpark, or you're going to spend $500 million and build a new facility? In the 60s, the decision was, let's build a new facility. So there was this long discussion about that. The idea was that Wrigley Field eventually would be turned into apartments. Fortunately for us, the White Sox backed out, and it never happened. When the Tribune Company bought the team, they actually bought some property out along Rolwig Road in Schaumburg. They actually still own that today, and there's some generators and stuff out there. There were some schematics you saw of a potential ballpark, but you know the reality is the transportation just simply wasn't there. So, and, you know, even with some of the lights issue, they talked about the possibility, but it really never got off a scratch pad, the idea of actually moving.
Thank you.
All right. Over here.
Hi there. I actually have two questions. My first is for Ed or for Fred. I was wondering if you guys had any funny questions, or not funny questions, funny memories of the visitor staircase and the visitor clubhouse. And my second is for Kelly. I was wondering if you guys, with the 1060 project, ever had any plans for the obstructed view seats?
I can speak to the visitors clubhouse being very small. And perhaps on purpose to make it kind of uncomfortable for the visitors. And then as a childhood fan, I was talking to Ed about this earlier. I remember the little concourse area up above leading from the visitors' dugout to their locker room. So if you're as a fan walking down the concourse, you used to be able to see the players walk across a little walkway to their locker room. And that was a thrill, as a fan of baseball and football. And I particularly remember Bears games. And my father and I would stand underneath this little walkway, and there's Johnny Unitas or any other, you know, prominent visiting player. And people would throw peanut shells at the players.
Or beer,
yeah. So I remember that. What was your other question?
My other question was for Kelly. I was wondering if with the 1060 project, you guys ever had any plans for the obstructed view seats?
I was just talking with one of our architects before this about obstructed views, but it wasn't in relation to Wrigley Field. My focus was on branding, so I can't speak to obstructed views. Also, we worked on the later renovations, whereas some of the Seating Bowl renovations were in earlier phases, so I apologize. Can't answer.
All right, we only have time for one more question.
Sorry. Yeah, maybe the last question dovetailed into that, and my first question. Some of what we saw is proposed that hasn't been done yet.
Everything you saw today were photographs of the completed work.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been in a ballpark since the last conference we had, which is, 8 years ago? And for old time's sake, my first game there was in 1982, where all-day games, got to sit in the center field bleachers, four or five rows away was Bill Veeck. So for old time's sake, I really wanted to be in the center field bleachers, but it was a night game. I'm wondering whether there's been any improvement in the labeling of the sections and seats out there in the center field bleachers. In the night, to go to the restroom and try to get back to where you were was really kind of interesting.
Well, you said 1982, so before the lights were installed?
Well, yeah, but that's how that was a day game. The question I asked about was a night game.
Yes. So part of what you saw was signage and wayfinding, and yes, we did significantly add directions to restrooms throughout the concourses.
Even though it was kind of fun to find your way back.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I wondered whether, like, converting to night games, there was pushback. Was there pushback for some of this modern jazzy stuff you've done?
I think our design challenge was to always make it so that it wasn't too modern. It was a modern amenity, but the design aesthetic was something that would honor the legacy and history, and that was our number one goal. As in anything that's put out in the world, there's usually some pushback, but I haven't received any personally.
Okay. Well, very good. I need to get back to the
All right. Well, listen, thank you to our panelists. thank you. In the audience, I hope you came away with a few nuggets of information that you didn't know before this session. That was our objective. Thank you very much.